Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. I'm Charlie Carter, and I'm here with Tim Little and Andy Stearns. Let's jump into the conversation. Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, and the Thinklings are excited here to have a special guest on our episode. Our guest today is Carolyn Weber. She is the author of Surprised by Oxford, which is her memoir of conversion while a student at Oxford University. And that will be what we discuss in the main content of our episode today. But of course, we have many things to do before we get there. Here is a little bit about Carolyn from her Twitter profile. It says, Professor of Literature, DPhil, Oxon, author, speaker, wife, fun mom to darling girl and a bunch of busy boys. And my book is now a film at Oxford Movie. And then there's Latin, which I don't necessarily know Latin, but tole lege, which means take up and read. Yeah. And then from your website, Carolyn, you say, you enjoy living in a quirky old house out in the country with her husband, four spirited children, grandma, along with their animal menagerie. So I thought that was fun. And then, Carolyn, you live in Tennessee and you teach at New College Franklin. Thanks for being here. And I do want to fit in a little bit of a pun. Thanks for volunteering for coming on our podcast.
Puns are the highest form of humor. So That's good, Charlie.
No.
All the listeners who have ever made fun of me, did you hear what she just said? Thank you very much. They're so good.
I have on a separate document, I have a list of other Tennessee puns. And that's the one I went with was the volunteer one. But I wanted to sprinkle in something about walking in Memphis there and just didn't quite feel like that would have worked. But anyway. Yeah. So thanks for being here.
You're welcome. It's lovely. I'm really, really grateful to join all of you. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. And tell us a little bit about New College Franklin. What's going on there?
New College Franklin is just a really neat place. I am so, so grateful to be teaching there. So I started there a couple of years ago, 3 years ago or so. And when we relocated to Nashville from Canada at the time, and I've taught many, many places, Charlie, for over 30 years, secular, Christian, large, small. I love being a professor. It's my first love is teaching. And New College Franklin is a small liberal arts college. It's based on a classical curriculum, a trivium quadrivium, and it's a small cohort of students. They all work together to do the same degree. And so what I love about it is all the subjects and ideas interlocked and build on each other, all to the glory of God. So it's really the undergraduate curriculum I wish I had taken. Wow. You study, you know, bits and pieces of everything from literature and philosophy and arithmetic and cosmology to music and harmonia and poetics and theology. It's just, it's amazing. And it all builds on each other and the faculty coordinate together. And the students also have spiritual formation. They work, you know, it's based on the concept of Bonhoeffer's Life Together, the idea that you also do community together. So it's a close-knit group. So it's just a wonderful experience. And I'm really blessed to teach there. It was founded years ago by Greg Wilbur, who's a fantastic musician and a very dear friend and has amazing vision. And it's just a really unusual and beautiful place.
So you teach some of the English classes, so great books or?
I do. I've taught in primarily in the trivium. I'm not a mathematics person, but I can admire it. But I've done logic, composition, and then I usually teach a moral philosophy, which is a combination of literature, philosophy, even psychology, when you get into moral philosophy four. And right now I'm doing a preceptorial on C.S. Lewis and spiritual formation as well.
Huh. That sounds interesting.
It is interesting. It's really, really delightful.
That's awesome. And just recently, the last 5 years, have learned what classical education is. And I'm slowly learning that what I called my education was not an education. And so I agree. I wish I would have had things like that. I mean, I went to Bible college where I had Tim and Andy as professors. So, you know, I really didn't get much. And so I really wish I could have done something
you
like this.
You can't say that when you have just voiced amazing puns. Of course, you've got a rich heritage.
See, Charlie, where did that come valid. From? Word of
the horrendous. What did I teach you in the Bible college?
That's actually nothing. Yes. Tim is a seminary professor. So.
Oh, that's wonderful. I think we can all feel that way. But what I do love about classical education, I think the resurgence of it is that reading of good books, right?
Yes.
Yes.
And the ideas, and that there's a long history of ideas that are really rich.
I think it's interesting. Oh, go ahead, Tim.
Our kids are in a classical, mm-hmm. Classical Conversations is the name of the program.
Mm-hmm. So, I know it well. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So my oldest son is also 15 and he's in the Challenge 2 program right now.
Okay.
And then another son's in Challenge A and Challenge B. So
Several of our students at New College come through that kind of program. We have many homeschoolers or classical educated students, but just really earnest students, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, I think what it does is it does create a conversation in their own mind and souls, right, about what really matters, which I think is often missing in the larger culture.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Excellent.
There's nothing better in class than students who are engaged and are willing to interact with you. And that's where mm-hmm. I feel like the classroom comes alive. So that sounds like
It's on a Socratic method model.
You know?
Mm-hmm. It's a tutorial. You have to be responsible for your ideas. You know, and really we don't deal with things like plagiarism, stuff like that. You know, students are taking responsibility. They're engaged, they're involved. They have to participate, defend, discuss. So it really eradicates all those problems. And you just get to the heart of the love and passion for what you're studying.
Speaking of great books that we would read in classical education, Tim, I think it's time for that thing we always do.
Books and business.
That thing.
Let's talk about some books. And Andy, you can go ahead and go first.
Sure. This week, I have almost finished a book called A Severe Mercy by Sheldon Vanneken. And it's going to be hard to talk about that without giving too much away. It is a memoir of a man who starts off his life as a pagan and experiences a really great relationship. And he's an agnostic atheist kind of a guy, and so is his partner. And as they live their life, they eventually begin encountering people who are Christians, and they encounter Christian thought. And so it's a bit of a story of them coming to Christianity. And then they end up walking a road of a trial. And so I think I'll leave it very short this week. And listeners, you know what I've walked through. And so it was a very interesting read and very familiar. And it was very good. If you haven't read it, I would pick it up. The only thing I would say is that the first couple chapters are definitely background. And you just need to push through them because it really picks up once the issues start arising in the book. But it's very, very good. A friend of mine recommended it to me. Shout out to Marshall Felderman. And then he said, maybe it's too soon. And it wasn't. It was a really good book. So Sheldon Vanneken, I will rate it very highly when I finish. And I'm very, very close to being finished. So very good book.
All right, Carolyn, you want to jump on into books and business?
Yes, I'll jump on in, which is so neat because Andy, that's the book I'm rereading right now. So
That is fantastic.
It's just amazing that that's happening. So I have reread that several times. I love that book. So I highly recommend it as well. And for me, it has a special story because it was way back when I was a graduate student at Oxford and I was not yet a Christian. It was a book that was handed to me by a friend as well. And I wasn't even thinking about the faith. It was just simply an invitational book to read. And I ended up reading it. And I was really moved, obviously, by the story. The story is amazing. And his description of Oxford makes me homesick when I read it now. But also the fact that he chronicles his, own conversion story in a very believable, real way. As I mentioned, that my boys are reading it right now. They are actually really resonating with it too. Mm-hmm. I think young people resonate with the story as well. That it's just very honest and real. The questions he grapples with, and his relationship. But it was also how I segued more into C.S. Lewis. So I think I was a perfect example of someone who knew Lewis, from Narnia and that as a child, but didn't know really much else of his range of genres and his or his theological input, and ended up, there are many letters in there between Lewis and Van because they became friends in England. So, and he I think wrote him with some questions at first when he was doubting So I have always really found that to be, I love the letters to Lewis there, and that really introduced me to more of C.S. Lewis at that time.
I thought the letter part was the not the best, absolute best part of the book. It was really, really good, though. I don't know what part I'd say is best. But I found Lewis answering real life questions, that's just where that guy shines so well. And I thought that you could actually just, if you just wanted to read the letters, that part alone would be worth it. I think the whole story makes it more complete. But yeah, those letters are really, really good.
He's a powerful letter writer, which is a really unique genre for someone to do. And he took it so seriously. You know, he really tried to respond to every letter.
Okay, I guess it's my turn.
Yes,
so,
it is,
Carolyn. you guys were kind of talking about that. That sounded a little bit like your book. I mean, this individual and a memoir and kind of walking through. Was that something that you had in mind when you were writing Surprise by Oxford?
You know, that's a great question. I never anticipated writing a memoir ever. I especially one about becoming a Christian.
Right.
As kind of a, you know, off-put agnostic, but it was years and years later. So I think in retrospect, it probably haunted it more than I thought. I didn't consciously sort of emulate Severe Mercy, you know, but I was evoking in the title Surprised by Joy, which was Lewis's own, you know, biography, sort of a hat tip to that. But also because Surprised by Joy actually comes from a Wordsworth poem. It's the title of a Wordsworth poem. Mm. And Lewis was borrowing from Wordsworth. And it's a beautiful little poem in which Wordsworth is taken surprise, the poet is taken by surprise when he experiences joy in a moment of grief, but then realizes like it's fleeting, and actually how the two are held in your hand at the same time. And but how Lewis, I think, responds to that is by looking at how, yes, the tomb is empty for us as believers, that grief is that even that joy and grief and joy is the longing that points us towards what we were made for. Mm-hmm. And those paradoxes are actually where the truth lies. And they are, you know, paradox is just a seeming contradiction, not a real one. So we can, holding those two things is actually more the nature of our faith. And so I was always really intrigued by the layers of that in there. So when I wrote my book, I was definitely years, many, many, many years later, shaped by those books that were precious to me through Sheldon's book and Lewis's. But
nice.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to talk about a book that nobody's going to probably care about, but The Old Testament as Literature, Tremper Longman III.
Yes, I taught with him at Westmont.
Oh,
yeah, that's a wonderful book. Yeah.
Okay. This one just came out, Foundations for Christian Interpretation. So he's written some stuff on genre, quite a bit of things on genre. Cracking Old Testament Codes was back in the 90s. And as I've been reading through this one, it sounds like that book a little bit. But Longman is very much into genre and genre studies. That's particularly apparent in the first part of the book, where the location of meaning, and so talking about genre and its connection to meaning. Chapter 3, genre triggers, reading strategy, and then narrative prose as genre. So the role of genre when it comes to hermeneutics and interpretation. So I have a section in one of my classes where I talk about genre, and my students have to read a section of Cracking OT Codes, which was written by Longman 30 years ago. So I might be incorporating a section of this book into that assignment instead. So my book's in business today, Longman's Old Testament as Literature.
Awesome. I'm also going to mention a book that Tim is going to particularly not care about. But
is it about chickens, Charlie?
Close. It's close.
Horrendous.
So recently,
a menagerie of animals.
We have chickens.
You have chickens? Tim, you should talk to Carol. She could have helped you understand how to do this.
Boys that eat their body weight like every hour. Of course,
exactly. I have four sons. Okay.
Yes, you should get chickens. Eggs are a good thing.
The city won't let me have them. Maybe you can help me out.
You can have covert chickens. The city doesn't need to know.
Tim. You could have done stealth chickens, man.
Stealth
come on.
Chickens.
Oh, my. Okay. So I recently received back a book from Taylor up at Hidden Acres, Tim and Andy, that I lent to him to read to his children because I told him that this is one of Tolkien's kids' favorite books. And so I actually just got it back yesterday morning and it was sitting at work. So I started reading back through it. And that's The Silver Trumpet by Owen Barfield.
Oh,
and yeah. It is just a wild kid story with princesses and princes and all a bunch of fun nonsense. And so anyway, yeah. So I think that it's just super fun. And Tim, I don't think you probably care about it at all, but it's a fun book.
My kids loved it.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And then, but then of course, the other book that I've been reading is Surprised by Oxford by Carolyn Weber. And we're going to talk about that in just a moment. But we do want to ask Carolyn a few extra questions before we jump into the book. So, Carolyn, I want you to tell me, why should someone ever read the Romantic Poets? Tell me why.
What a rhetorical question.
Rhetorical question. I love it. That's great.
The answer is so obvious, Tim. Come on.
So I just told you Surprised by Joy came from Wordsworth.
Yes. Yes.
Right. The Romantic writers, okay, I know people have love-hate relationships with them, including Lewis, but he was a closet romantic. They are so important because I landed on them. I love all authors' books, as you know, all time periods, but because the Romantics were fascinated by that notion of infinite longing, the German Romantics, the British Romantics, I would even argue transatlantic when it moves in a sense to the States as well, Canada, the States, there's probably one of the most dominant themes is that notion of longing and infinite longing, as Goethe describes as well, that or Sehnsucht, as Lewis talks about it, that longing, that desire for something that we can't fully have, but points us to the home for which we were made. And so we have kind of a foretaste of heaven in that sense on this side of things. I feel that the first generation romantics, the earlier writers and the ones even post-revolution still have that, maybe slightly different approaches to it, and they're responding to each other. But I really think it's one of the most complicated and rich times in literature from sort of that 1780s to 1850.
I have been chewing on all summer The Rime of the Ancient Mariner.
Were going to say The Rind of the Ancient Mariner if you're chewing.
Oh, Charlie, there's your pun right there, buddy.
I did not start the pun fest.
This is wonderful.
I won't add to it.
I'm just Tennessee waltzing through this interview.
Amen.
We need like a pun counter, you know, a ding every time. No. And we can count it up by the
dunk,
end.
With a dunk ding. Yep.
Yes.
If you have boys, you know those.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah. But yes, it just started dabbling in. And so, yes.
It's so good.
There is a lot of fun in the lyrical ballads. That's something I'm also still working through. And because you can read it through quickly and kind of catch the tone and the candor of the poem, but then you kind of have to think back through them again. And because some of them, I'm just not always in the mental space to really grasp what they're talking about.
But the Ancient Mariner is so haunting and
beautiful
ballad.
It boggled me. Yeah.
It's just like one that on a lonesome road doth walk in fear and dread. That notion of like the doppelganger right behind you and being pursued by your own inner demons. It's just brilliant. I love it. It's so fun. And Malcolm Guite does a beautiful study on it as well. It's attracted so many, thinkers around that notion because it is such a haunting text.
So they say that writers are always readers, or at least they should be. And so good writers are good readers. How do you, like, what's your reading habit like? How regularly do you read? Do you have a pattern of books you're cycling through? Is it whatever your hand picks up? Do you have 10 going at once? Do you just stick to one? Like, tell us about reading.
I always love that question because I like to learn how other people are reading too. I admire people who cycle through, I have friends who are really systematic readers, and I just think that's so admirable. I feel like Emily Dickinson, whenever I try to organize something, my little force implodes. I probably was more like that as an undergraduate and a graduate, but once I had children, that went out the window. And, I remember at one point having three children under three and my husband and I just looking at each other, and it's a good day if you're showered. So I think after that, I just sort of went to whatever. I think reading changes for me based on seasons. and how I read based on life seasons. So I have had times where I'm very systematic, and especially if I'm researching or writing a book or working on a dissertation, I'll, you know, be reading really systematically through something. But, you know, when people are all playing at the playground and they're little and you're basically just trying to keep your children alive, you know, then I read a lot of shorter items, you know, or things like that. But I tend to be a time of day reader. I have certain things I like to read in the morning, certain things I like to read during the day, or, you know, and you probably know as teachers, you're reading and rereading around your syllabi all the time too, and then reading in the evening. And I felt very vindicated that, Alistair McGrath told me he does this too. I tend to try and read something kind of light in the evening. I learned that if I end up reading something very heavy or methodical, I'll stay up, you know, I'll stay up grappling with it. Okay. Or even if I want to unravel, you know, a really intense mystery, I don't trust myself to put the book down. I will stay up all night and then I'm exhausted the next day. So often in the evenings, I'll give myself permission, you know, to read something kind of lighter or whatever at night. But I just always have a book with me. I don't blame e-readers, but I love the feel of a book, the smell of a book. So I usually have different books in different purses, bags, cars, whatever. So that my mom was always very good about, you know, you're going to spend a lot of your life in line or waiting. So always have a book. And I just love everything. You know, you can whip out, you know, the romantic, so you can rip out Irma Bombeck, you know, it's all great. And you just, yeah, it's, she's great. She's very profound. So like there's, you know, I just love everything and anything. And, but I'm, systematic probably in what I read during the day at what times, but I kind of like to read everything.
That's really cool. Do you, do you mark your books up?
Like, I absolutely do. I'm a bookmarker. Yeah, and I know that that is what it comes down to. It's not the city of God or city of man. It's who marks their books and who doesn't. You know, I've heard, no, people are really upset about that division. Have you heard, like, just go on Twitter with that and just watch the response.
Oh, yeah.
Some people are purists. You do not mark your books. You do not touch them. And other people, maybe it's the Coleridgean in me. He was a marginalia guy. He even published his marginalia. As marginalia, which I think is really hilarious, but I love to interact with books. Wow.
That sounds like the footnotes versus endnotes debate on Twitter too. I don't know if I want to get into that, but I know
all those upset footnotes theology are right. People, because they've lost their footnotes where they can just wax on.
we better move on. Yes. Well, that's really interesting. So the time of day reading, that's interesting. I had not thought of that before. I think I've tried systematic. Right now I'm in a season where it's just like, I'm just trying to read whatever I can. So
Right. I think it just changes with life seasons. Yeah. But sometimes I'll get on certain authors. Don't you find that too? Like, you just gorge. It's like the Netflix equivalent to author. You know, I'll read an author. I did that with Elizabeth Googe, and I was like, oh, she's amazing. And all of a sudden you're reading all, you know, that will happen to me as well.
Sometimes it'll also be the citation trail. So like, I think I was thinking of reading Severe Mercy. I think you mentioned that in your book too. Mm-hmm. And then I heard it somewhere else. I'm like, well, I got to read this. And then as you're reading, you like get a longer list over here, and it doesn't end.
It doesn't end, nor should it.
You mentioned in Surprised by Oxford, Chesterton. Mm-hmm. Chesterton was right when he claimed that the Christian ideal has not been tried and found wanting. It has been found difficult and left untried, which is a great quote. Mm-hmm. And it just made me think through, you know, what works of Chesterton. So I'm an Old Testament guy. Literature is something that I'm trying to get into. You know, Charlie brings up the Mariner book. I can't even get the title right still. But Chesterton, I've done a little bit of reading of Chesterton, and what would be like your favorite Chesterton title? If you were going to recommend even, say, like one Chesterton title, what would be maybe something that you'd put near the top of that list?
That's such a hard question, because he's so prolific and he's so different and he's so logical and engaging, but then also mystical. He's a really interesting character. And so, I mean, of course there's Everlasting Man and Orthodoxy, because those really influenced Lewis. I think that they're very readable and very articulate in terms of the faith. But then you also get Chesterton, where he's just super quirky. And I love that, like ball in the cross, you know, he's just a hoot and puts, you know, and puts, has this way of putting very different people together in a story and lets them box it out.
Mm-hmm. Is that a fictional title? One of his mm-hmm. fiction ones, Ball in the Cross?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it's really quite fun to watch, you know, like a demon and a priest have it out. So like there's, I think he's quite, there's a range for him.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful book on him, The Mysticism of Him by Father Wild. I just love that name. Like if I were a priest, I'd want to be Father Wild. And you know, as opposed to like nun boring, but you know, he was, he talks about that range and like the, how he's actually quite really comfortable with paradox, which we don't see many mm-hmm. authors being. And mm-hmm. that's one of the things I love about Chesterton. He can be long-winded, but I think he's worth the labyrinth,
yeah.
you know, to get to the jewel.
So for fiction, The Ball and the Cross, and for nonfiction, probably one of his classics like Orthodoxy or Everlasting
yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Surprise by Oxford. You mentioned Alistair McGrath a few moments ago, so let's read his quote or his caption on the front. A hugely readable journey of cultural and spiritual discovery, sparkling with wit and wisdom. And Surprise by Oxford is your memoir of going to Oxford as not a Christian and having many wonderful, fun experiences, but then ultimately leading to your conversion, which then the book does transition to and includes growing in grace and your baptism and things like that. It's a wonderful story to read through. I actually have gifted it to a couple people in my life who are not believers and hoping and praying for them as they read it. But we each, I think, have some questions about the book. I'm going to start here. There's an idea you presented in, it's on page 100, and you talk about this gospel hangover. Like you had just told in the previous chapter, the first time that you heard the gospel, and then you say this, you say, the morning after I heard the gospel, however, I woke up with what felt like a hangover. Little would I know it was of the spiritual kind that accompanies the inevitable dawn of realization that life is not, perhaps, what we previously thought it was. And can you talk about that, your first time hearing the gospel and what that was like as obviously a quite intelligent student at Oxford, but then realizing that your worldview is maybe a little off?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always a little frightening when people quote you back, but...
Yes, a little bit.
Happens all the time. Happens all the time.
I think it's, I mean, I'm like so many others in North America, you know, I think where we can presume that people know the gospel, but they actually haven't heard it or heard it clearly. And I was an example, as I've said to students before, of somebody who had gone through, never really read the Bible, you know, cover to cover, had heard of Jesus, but didn't really know of a personal relationship, hadn't really heard of the notion of grace, you know, gone a little bit to church here and there with my family, you know, new bits and pieces from the media, my goodness, you know, like 80s and 90s, where, you know, had no idea what U2 was really singing about, you know, those kind of things. And and I would have been, I probably define myself as agnostic because I couldn't disprove God. And I agree with William Drummond when he says, you know, don't give people a thumbful of the gospel, give them the whole thing. You know, it can be really condescending to kind of hold something back because you feel that, you know, it's embarrassing or they won't be able to understand that or take that. And I finally just had, I was meeting Christians from all over the world because in the graduate school in Oxford, it's so cosmopolitan. So I was meeting all these people who were from literally all over the place, especially Commonwealth countries, which are all over the world. I was on a Commonwealth scholarship myself. Some wealthy, some very, very poor, and they all believed in this same Jesus, which is why Mere Christianity really spoke to me later. But that was really intriguing, who this person was, this God that they all knew from such different backgrounds and believed the same things in. but when I had clearly heard the gospel, what God had done for us on the cross and the grace that he extends to us, and that it's entirely by his mercy and not by anything we can earn, you can't unhear that.
Yeah.
And people are either going to kick and scream against it, or, you know, or they're, I mean, it's the parable of the seed, right? You know, it's,
yeah,
it's going to sit with you, or it's going to be really irritating, or you're going to ignore it, but you can't unhear it.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of becomes this elephant in the room. Mm-hmm. And so I just remember the next day, I mean, it is a headache. It's incredibly inconvenient, especially if you've kind of lined up your life, right? Where you're going to achieve, yeah, what you want to achieve, and you're going to pull yourself by your bootstraps, and everything is how you earn it. And, you know, I came from a background of very much having to be self-sufficient, and,
mm-hmm,
and, but, you know, any of us do that in terms of the form of control, and, you know, we're not going to bend our knees to anything. And so it was like, ooh, that was really, really inconvenient. And then it sort of sits with it, and you have to think, and this goes back to, I think, what I loved about A Severe Mercy was where Sheldon Van Auken talks about not, it wasn't so much a leap of faith, you know, that everybody feels we have to take this leap of faith, and that's the terrifying thing. It was the falling back. He ended up not being able to deny who Jesus was. And so it was almost like a falling back with the gap. That sort of helped me in my unbelief, is his prayer. And I resonated with that. So I think that was what I meant by a hangover, is that was kind of like, ooh, you just sort of feel like something has happened where you either need to give this thing serious thought. And if you do, it changes everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting, because it reminds me of two things. Number one, when Lewis in Surprised by Joy makes his treaty with reality, because he's going to go into the war, but he's not going to let Britain have another day. And then part of what he didn't like about God is he didn't want people like meddling in his life.
Right.
And then Van Auken was the same thing. He, remember how he only gave a little bit and his wife gave more, and
mm-hmm,
it is, that's a very interesting observation there.
And because, as Lewis says, you know, the God wants all of you, not,
yeah,
some of, mm-hmm, you. Yeah.
We're very prone to give him a little bit or what we want, but the, sure, whole part, that's what's really painful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When I teach apologetics here, and I teach a lot of little courses. I'm not in like one area, but one of them is apologetics. And so I'm familiar with argumentation and arguments and whatnot. As I read this, I really enjoyed that I could tell you were bringing up apologetic questions throughout. At least that's what it seemed like. But it also didn't seem like you were setting out to say, let's talk about the argument for, or let's talk about the argument for, but very naturally in the conversations with your friends or some of your internal questionings, you brought those things up. And the way you did it, I do feel like Charlie said, I could hand this book to someone who's a reader, but maybe doesn't know the Lord yet. And I think it would be good for them.
Mm.
Is that something that you did on purpose? Like when you wrote the book, were you writing it for you before you got saved on some level?
Hmm. That's a great question. I think primarily, Andy, I was writing it with one foot in each world. You know, I had become a Christian and had a, you know, friends and a world actually in England, you know, in that sense. But my family and friends back in Canada were all unbelievers predominantly. Mm. Or my professors, you know, there were very few that, you know, some people I recognized later who were Christians, or some people who had been praying for me and those kind of things. So when I finally wrote the book, it was largely for those people, like thinking about how much I love and care for them, and wanting to share that with them. So I think what's really beautiful about apologetics is, yes, it can seem like it's something that's removed and, you know, and rhetorically probably presupposed, organized, but it's actually the questions that come up within us, you know, that are really genuine in who we are. When we were talking about Lewis being a letter writer, you know, as well, like, you know, he's, mm-hmm, responding to people's inner apologetics.
Yeah.
You, mm-hmm, know, we're asking ourselves, you know, who is this person, this Jesus? And when he's asking us in the Bible, I mean, the Bible's pointed all the way through with questions that are basically, you know, apologetics in the scripture. You know, who do you say I am? And, you know, are you your brother's keeper? And those are all questions we're asking ourselves, just variants of that. You know, am I really responsible for that person? Am I, you know, who is Jesus to me? I have to answer that question. Who's God to me? Those, I think, in a sense, apologetics just puts it out there, what we're already grappling with inside, that psychomachia within ourselves. And so when I was writing it, I was thinking about the questions I genuinely had, very genuinely had, as an growing up as an unbeliever and in our culture, and you know, everything that can be, you know, hugely theological and profound, to things like, you know, hey, can I still like Steppenwolf and be a believer? Like, you know, you know, that's the world I came from. I have a big brother who was a disc jockey, a rock and roll disc jockey, and you know, younger sister is a cheerleader, and you know, people of all stripes and people. Mm-hmm. I think again, it's what Lewis said: people don't believe that faith is relevant to their own lives, and that's as true for us now as it is to the Romans, as it was to, you know, the ancient world, as it is to World War II when your plane is going down, as he opens New Christianity with. So it's those enduring questions that I think are within it. It wasn't anything I plotted out, but just trying to write and speak to the questions that I had and I know others did.
Well, I really liked it. My I have two children, and my son had he recently got saved. It would have been in May. But it's interesting because we went through kind of a rough year last year as a family, and he was asking these questions as a 9-year-old. He's like, hey, if God can do anything, why doesn't he just make a world where there's no pain? And he's 9 years old.
Of course.
And so I think these questions probably exist inside of us at an earlier age than maybe some people are recognizing. But your book, the way it was discussed, it didn't seem like you had to have an apologetics degree, or I mean, it was just you were talking about life. And you were bringing up those issues. So, okay, that was very helpful. I really enjoyed that part of the book, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
So, you had this one dialogue between Dr. Sterling and Dr. Inchbold at the high table, which was an interesting British, I don't know, Oxford conversation. Yeah. And there was a few things that I found fascinating. One is that you basically seem to have run into a couple of people who are very educated, very well-known and established in their fields, and they were struggling with these same questions about God. And particularly Dr. Inchbold, when you tell this story about the ping. And I didn't quite get that. What's up with the ping? He's like nervous and he starts to be shaking, like, and he's supposed to cut into like a person's heart or something. And he's like, what's going on? And then this ping. Could you maybe explain that a little bit?
I'm thinking about, I mean, of course, I was drawing on the pun from Monty Python, but the meaning of life.
Okay, so I probably didn't catch that for some reason.
That was my own little inside joke.
On our podcast, when there's a cultural reference, there's a lower percentage that Tim's going to catch it than me and Charlie. So, but I didn't catch that one either.
That's all right, Tim. You're not dead yet.
That was good. I caught that one. That was really good.
I think these questions are all, we're all asking them. It doesn't, whatever we do for a living and wherever we're at, and believer or not, it's not like if we're believing or Christians, those questions are answered. We're probably asking them in different ways in different seasons. But I've been struck by people, and that was an example where I think at Oxford and, Superior Mercy talks about this too. I was really moved and impressed by how people could have conversations about all sorts of things. Uh-huh. And you're not judged by them. You know, you can just have a conversation. And it's that Aristotelian notion of entertaining many ideas without necessarily accepting them. And so there was that kind of conversation. And so I got to meet again all stripes of Christians, you know, as well as people who weren't, that were able to talk about things from all kinds of angles. So that idea of, I think, again, the awakening of life and death, I was struck that someone who would be in the science field would actually see science as even further proof for their faith, but also the fact of working daily with death being all the more convicting that it was wrong. And I've heard this since from so many others as well, like just that we are not made for death. And, you know, I've several friends of mine actually that work in palliative care or, you know, hospice, or I have a lot of friends who are nurses and things too, who are believers, you know, and you think, how can you be a believer if you're working in hospice? Like that just must wear you down, or the answer to that. But it's the same question that the 9-year-old asks, the 90-year-old asks, and you know, it's going to ebb and flow and consolation and desolation when we feel close to God in a way that I think it one of the great level or philosophical questions is what happens to us when we die, mm-hmm. you know, and it, that's, I mean, as Lewis says, 100% of us die, right? You know, and
he's
everybody,
good at some math.
Yeah, you know, in his learning in wartime essay where he says, you know, people mm-hmm. are saying, well, why should you study the humanities? Why should you be reading books, you know, when we're at war? What purpose or, you know, how can that be, have any kind of purpose? And he says, well, we're all going to die. There's never a right time to be a perfect time, you know, to be doing anything or to be thinking anything. It's not like our fate, I think it's Peter Kreef who says, you know, like life is fatal, you know? So I think I was struck by different people in different walks of life having these similar questions. Mm-hmm. And of course, Oxford is, it's not to romanticize it, but parts of it are so beautiful. I mean, really high table dinner when you're talking by candlelight in this pool of light in a dark room and you've had a beautiful meal. It's very Virginia Woolf, right? You know, where she compares the poor meal and when your stomach's grumbling, it's hard to think great thoughts as opposed to the wonderful meal. And then you have, you know, port and everything afterwards. We, you know, the Lord does say take and eat, right? As Lewis says, mm-hmm. not just take and think. And so there's, the idea that, you know, our bodies and our minds are connected. Bread is both what we eat and our daily bread is also scripture. And so being able to recognize that we were spiritual as well as physical beings, that there was something else we yearned for and feasted on and all came to grips with in some way, or faced in some way in terms of our own mortality. That's, you know, the stories of the oldest myths. So just to be able to see those questions come up and be responded to in really thoughtful ways from all different stripes and professions really spoke to me.
As you have those conversations, one of the more profound things you have to think through is, what is the airspeed velocity of a swallow?
You beat me to it, Charlie. I was totally going to ask that one.
Tim, do you have any idea what I just...
No.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's what I thought. So I do think as you read through this book, listener, it is a lot of conversations with friends of different perspectives and a lot of processing about Jesus. And I think that's what I appreciated the most is just tracking that journey with so many different friends and circulating that idea. And then obviously in God's sovereignty that he uses those in your spiritual life to lead you to himself, which is wonderful. And so a great book. There are so many chapters where I thought there was a quote that'd be fun to talk about. We obviously can't do that. So Tim and Andy, if there's absolutely something you want to talk about, you jump in. And then, you know, I have a couple things to wrap us up at the end. But anything else you guys want to talk about?
I do have one more. I have two more, actually. One's about the book and serious, and one's just silly. But about the book, I don't know. So TDH.
Yeah.
Why did you pick TDH and not the real name? I'm just so curious. It was such a neat thing because the whole time I'm like, well, what? Like, it kept me on my
toes. Now TDH because he's tall, bald, and handsome. But
no, TD. Yeah. I said D. Oh no, I'm not trying to impugn his character. Well, if he is, he's B now. Oh, okay. Hey, sorry about that. I didn't mean to bring that one up. Yeah, no, if your husband's listening, hey, I didn't mean to throw her into the bus, man.
No, it's good. It's like the Kojak look. It's sexy.
Hey, don't mess with him.
I know. Or you'll get the lollipop. I am so old. It's not even funny.
This is great. This is really good. Really good.
Well, I use TDH partly as an inside joke because that's what my girlfriends start calling him.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But also because my husband, this is hilarious. He's just really introverted and wouldn't want any attention. So yeah. So I think it would have been mortifying, you know, so it was just a great way to write the manuscript without him knowing what I was up to till it was too late. And then
that's glorious.
And then
that
really
is fantastic.
My hand till the end. So
yeah.
It's probably like mortifying for him, but I thought I would do it because it was a term of endearment and it's sort of what my friends, as an inside joke among us, refer to him. And to just sort of, yeah, probably keep that, some of that kind of mysterious.
I didn't think about that until I'd gotten near and maybe done with it the second time. And I realized, like, I think that part of it was really fun. The whole time you were kind of guessing, like, where's this going? And wait, why isn't she saying his name? Is like something bad or something good going to happen? It was the whole time I thought that was kind of interesting. So.
Oh, thanks.
Kind of added to the mystery. I had one question. How many chickens do you guys have?
Now or as of like last week?
You know, it's always changing. They're chickens.
I know.
Did a bunch of them die? Or
we had a raccoon hit last week.
Oh,
we were doing really well. So we've had as many as 30, but they took a hit because they were free rangers a year or so ago, and we were new to Tennessee predators.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
literally.
Wow.
Yeah, but in Canada, the chickens didn't take as much of a hit unless predators were really hungry, you know, like really cold, really hungry.
Yeah.
And especially with the kids playing outside, but here we found them to be a little more aggressive. So, we're at 9 now. We had 11, for a bit. So we're at 9. Yeah.
Okay. That's it. I'm good. I was just wondering about the chickens.
They're prolific. Like they produce a lot of eggs. They're busy ladies.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. Okay, here's my last question for you. So my wife and I went to Banff this summer, and I was messaging with a friend who's Canadian, and my friend said, hey, if you want the real Canadian, because I told him, I said, hey, I tried gravy with my fries and it wasn't that great. And he said, look, if you tried poutine and there wasn't cheese curds, you're doing it wrong. You need to start over.
Absolutely.
So anyways,
what are you doing?
Well, I don't know.
Fries with gravy, but poutine.
I'm a Northern American. I don't know. So anyway, so my friend says, I said, what's the Canadian experience? And so he said, you got to get ketchup flavored potato chips at the gas station.
Yes.
I tried that. I ate like half the bag. That was interesting. I did get poutine twice. I just am fascinated by this. Like, where does it come from? What's the lore? I want to know the lore. But then he said to try Smarties because they're not the same thing as the States.
No, they're not.
They're not. So here's my question. How long have you lived in Tennessee?
About 3 years, but we lived on the West Coast in the States for some time prior to being in Canada. Yeah.
So what do you miss what in Canada do you miss that you don't have down here?
Oh.
Like if you could bring something from Canada down to the States, what would you bring?
My mom, because we've been separated by immigration,
aww.
Which has been painful, but for her, U.S. immigration. I love Americans. I'm married to one and my kids are dual, but I do miss a lot of Canadian things. So I do miss Smarties, Coffee Crisp. We have a chocolate bar called Coffee Crisp and it is incredible.
Really?
It has like coffee flavoring. We have a chocolate bar. Our chocolate bars are amazing. Score. It's got like a toffee type of thing.
Okay.
Like a Heath maybe, but a bit better. I miss Tim Hortons coffee. Which I've never seen Tim Hortons more Southern than maybe Chicago, like, and not often, you know.
Yeah.
Tim Hortons coffee is really cheap. You can still get a coffee for under $2, which Canadians call toonies because we have a loonie, which is like a golden corn for
really?
And a toonie, right? Which has got loons on it. So they call it a toonie.
Wow.
So you actually really make money. Kids are excited because you actually make real money when you have Easter egg hunts.
Oh, that's really fun. Wow. Yeah. That is interesting.
As opposed to American dimes and quarters. And poutine is great. It's a great comfort food because you can also add like bacon bits, things like that.
Yep.
I miss like hot chocolate when you're at arenas and skating. I love the Great Lakes, that when you actually get in water here in the Great Lakes, it's refreshing. And nothing in it will kill you. Tennessee, like there's water moccasins and there's just things.
Okay.
Just things.
Wow. Okay.
That live
in
the water that I don't like. You know,
I do believe there is a Hortons in St. Louis.
Really?
Yes. It's not in I guess I don't know St. Louis that well, but I didn't perceive it to be in the best part of town, but there is one there.
They're very Canadian. We're just going to put them there because they got the cheap coffee.
And then right around the corner from that, there's actually a really, I mean, there's a lot of these, but a really good barbecue restaurant is just down the road. So
that's always really important to know. You need to know those places, because when I drive 75 going up and down to Canada often, mm-hmm. it's, you know, I've only seen maybe one or two.
Where do you go across the border when you're going home?
Anywhere along the Great Lakes, because my hometown's London, Ontario. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I can go Port Huron or Windsor. We have family in Windsor. We've done Buffalo before. So really anywhere. So Banff is much more west, you know, we've been out west, but yeah. I'm from the Southern Ontario area.
Yeah. I did a pastoral internship in near Syracuse.
Yeah.
And then one of my closest friends lives in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Right.
And so
right.
the quickest route is to go right through. And so I've been right through there many times. And
yeah,
so
I know Michigan really well. Yeah. Yeah. It's a great spot. Yeah.
I think that as I drive out to Michigan, the first Hortons is Kalamazoo. So
I'll keep that in mind.
Yeah. So
I know that they're few and far between here.
Got to get the Timbits.
Sort of look
too.
At Starbucks and it's just so expensive. And it's
The Timbits really are they're so
Timbits.
Good.
Fresh, real donuts. Even my husband will say that. Like Americans don't have fresh donuts. Yeah. It's very hard to find really good fresh donuts. So those are great.
There are a lot of great Canadian things that we could keep talking about, but we do want to be sensitive to your time here. And
then there's also some things that are not so great. So what comes out? What's up?
That sure. Sure.
Get great donuts, but you have, you know, euthanasia rise. So there you go. It's kind of comes out in the wash.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it a wash?
So here's kind of our last question for you. And then I have one more quote and we'll go into that final meditation here. If you could go back to yourself at the beginning of when you started writing this book or back earlier in your life, you can pick the timing of your younger self. And there's a practice or a habit in your intellectual life or spiritual life that you've started doing, you're doing it now, and you could go back and have started it at a younger point in your life. What would that thing be?
Ooh, yeah. Well, you know, I didn't grow up being a Christian, so I wish I had. I mean, it's that old, everybody's a Peter or Paul, right, or somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. So I wish I always, when I became a Christian, almost grieved that I hadn't known God longer. You know, mm-hmm. in that capacity, envied people who automatically prayed, you know, or had that. Mm-hmm. But if I could have known him earlier, that would have been wonderful. But I think even just the practice of being quiet and still, you know, obviously in the Lord or in reading scripture or in just listening to his voice or in having a quiet space. I think I've tried to work on that more as a spiritual discipline over the years, but even to have known that younger, even to instill in our children that it's okay not always to be so busy or rushing or distracted more than ever now, right? Because there's so many things coming at them in our culture. And that rise of anxiety and the anxious generation, all those things, like there's just so much distraction. And it's not necessarily that all those things are bad, but distraction is, you know, dis off of the traction, off of your tracks, you know? So this sense of even from a young age, getting back on track, being able to have the capacity and the tools to even, I think quite young, to be able to sit and know that it's okay to sit. It's okay to be still. I think children want to do that anyway, learn towards that anyway through imagination and play, you know, especially when they're given that opportunity, which is more and more important all the time because, you know, because of screens and things. I think there is that space to just look at the swallow and wonder how fast it flies, right? But we underestimate how much is happening. We dismiss leisure or just observation or paying attention or being still is equated with not doing something, but it's often doing what's most important of all.
Awesome. So I stumbled upon this quote, and it's actually why we're going to read some Psalm 66 at the end of our podcast here. You say this in, it's on page 404. And you say, it is an utter delight to be friends with other romantics. It is also safe enough to share with them Psalm 66. I was like, well, you know, that just might be what we need to talk about at the end of the podcast. And so Psalm 66 for our final meditation, and you discuss this, it becomes a part of the story with your baptism and one of your friends and a gift that they gave you, and thought that was a particularly moving scene where many of your friends are present when you declare your faith. I thought that's just a fun part of the book. Mm-hmm. And so thought that'd be a fitting place to end our podcast. So this is Psalm 66. Shout for joy to God, all the earth. Sing the glory of his name. Give to him glorious praise. Say to God, how awesome are your deeds. So great is your power that your enemies come cringing to you. All the earth worships you and sings praises to you. They sing praises to your name, Selah. Come and see what God has done. He is awesome in his deeds toward the children of man. He turned the sea into dry land. They passed through the river on foot. There did we rejoice in him, who rules by his might forever, whose eyes keep watch on the nations. Let not the rebellious exalt themselves, Selah. Bless our God, O peoples, let the sound of his praise be heard, who has kept our soul among the living and has not let our feet slip. For you, O God, have tested us. You have tried us as silver is tried. You brought us into the net. You laid a crushing burden on our backs. You let men ride over our heads. We went through fire and through water. Yet you have brought us out to a place of abundance. I will come into your house with burnt offerings. I will perform my vows to you, that which my lips uttered and my mouth promised when I was in trouble. I will offer to you burnt offerings of fattened animals. With the smoke of the sacrifice of rams, I will make an offering of bulls and goats, Selah. Come and hear, all you who fear God, and I will tell you what he has done for my soul. I cried to him with my mouth, and high praise was on my tongue. If I had cherished iniquity in my heart, the Lord would not have listened, but truly God has listened. He has attended to the voice of my prayer. Blessed be God, because he has not rejected my prayer or removed his steadfast love from me. And a couple of quick notes here. It's a really fun transition in the psalm where he looks back at how God had been faithful to the nation, what he did for Israel, and even very poignantly, you know, walking them through the Red Sea and allowing difficult nations to conquer them, but he remained faithful. And because of that, then he switches in verse 13, instead of a plural command, all you people, he says, I will do this. I will offer to you. And it's a great reflection on being faithful to God because he's faithful to us. And I think that was such a fun psalm to study in the context of your memoir, Carolyn, because we see this in all of our lives, but your book reminds us of God's faithfulness to us through his mm-hmm. son. And so just so thankful for what God does for us. And listener, as you reflect on that, as you pick up a copy of Surprised by Oxford, you can, with us, rejoice that God is good to his people and he's faithful. And then you can make that personal in the same way, that you can say, you know, I will be faithful to him because of his character and who he is. And so a great final thought there. And we'll end our episode here by just saying thank you, Carolyn, for coming and spending some time with us. I wish we had all day to do this, but we'll have to do it again sometime.
That sounds wonderful. I could definitely spend hours with you all in a pub. You're just a delight. It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Yes.
Thanks for coming, Carolyn.
Yes. Thank you very much. It was fun. I really did enjoy this book a lot. It was a really good thing to read at that time in my life. So thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. It's just a delight and honor to be here with you guys.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind. See you next time on the Thinklings Podcast.